Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to today's webinar hosted by Kynexus. I'm Mark Raven, Senior Advisor from Kynexus. I'm really excited that we are joined by our presenter, Elizabeth Swan, giving a presentation titled Deepen Your Lean Leadership Skills with Brain Science. So I will tell you more about Elizabeth, a more formal introduction in a minute, but welcome. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Elizabeth Swan has consulted in the business process performance industry for over 30 years. Her experience spans from helping local nonprofits expand their reach to guiding Fortune 100 companies through lean transformations. She has trained and mentored thousands through their improvement projects, generating millions in savings. Elizabeth has deep expertise coaching problem solvers and facilitating leadership retreats, strategic planning sessions, process walks, and Kaizen events. Among other things, she is the co-designer and lead instructor for the Lean Six Sigma Leadership Course at the University of California, San Diego. She's a co-founder of the Just In Time Cafe and co-host of the Just In Time Cafe podcast, so check that out. She previously co-authored a book, The Problem Solver's Toolkit, A Surprisingly Simple Guide to Your Lean Six Sigma Journey, and her latest book, just released this month, hot off the presses on the Amazon new release and some bestseller lists, not just for new releases. That new book is titled Picture Yourself a Leader, Illustrated Micro Lessons for Navigating Change. So, Elizabeth, it's been great collaborating with you over time. You being on my podcast, me being there with you in the Just In Time Cafe. Congratulations again on the book and really excited to hear what you have to share. I will turn it over to you.
All right. Thank you, Mark. So this webinar is just a product of having written the book. And it's based on what I learned while kind of finding out why we have influence, why we don't have influence, you know, what gets in our way. And a lot of it turned out to be what's going on in our brains. So today we're going to look at, you know, what gets in the way of good problem-solving mindsets, you know, how brain science helps and hinders, and then ways we can adapt and leverage based on that reality. So this is a quote I often say to folks I'm coaching, right? Facts and data often fail to move hearts and minds. And it's, you know, people get frustrated. I see them like, well, this is clearly a problem. Why are people not reacting to this? Why aren't they getting on board? And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why. And I'm going to give you an example that I think makes a good case. And this one is, it's funny. This is a story I told for a while that it was based on a problem solver at Alberta Health Systems, where I worked for a while. And then I thought, wait a second, did I read this? Was it in On the Mend? I recently texted Mark and I said, did you write about this in Lean Hospitals? You know how your memory can kind of get another thing your brain does, right? You store your memories the way you want. But either way, the story's true. So the issue was the hospital was ordering and storing dozens of varieties of gloves with different SKUs, the stop keeping unit numbers. And the project lead said, well, these seem very similar, right? So it caused confusion. Which gloves do you order? There's the reality of these gloves having a 3-year lifespan. So they also taking up lots of storage and they were being tossed out when they expired. So he put together an A3 and he shopped this idea around looking for people to back him and sponsor this project where he thought he had a lot of opportunity. And the reaction he did not expect was people said, well, you know, we totally understand doctors might need different gloves, right? Based on what they're doing, based on what they're used to, based on what they need. And they're trying to serve patients. So this doesn't sound like a good use of, it doesn't like a good effort, good project to focus on. So what he did was, and this is my facsimile of what he did, but he went and bought or found in storage one pair of each of the gloves they had on hand, and he put them on a table in the middle of a conference room. And he showed them, and people were like, wow, I did not know that the gloves were that similar, right? That this is just, and how many of these, you know, are we actively ordering and why? And so that this finally started to move folks, right? Like, and so he did a, he got a roadshow and he went to the different hospitals in the network and showcased just the reality of what was happening. And that actually shifted, right? That shifted everyone's thinking. And they said, oh, well, yeah, we need to reduce all these SKUs. We need to narrow it down. And then the article Mark forwarded this morning to me was the results of a hospital glove project with New York Health and Hospital Corporation. They stocked 20 varieties of rubber gloves, different colors, thicknesses. And as a result of their investigations, they reduced it so doctors could choose from two types. Then they could negotiate the price of the 132,000 cases of gloves they ordered every year, down from $58 a case to $28 a case. So that one project had a savings of $4 million a year on gloves, right? So that's just massive. And this made the difference. So then I just wondering what makes the difference in turn? Why does this image, why did that pile of gloves make such a difference? And it has to do with how our brain works. So do a little simulation with you. It's walking through a process here. So I'm animating what our brains go through, and I'm doing it obviously very slowly, but let me walk you through what happens. So the way we process text is first our brain sees these little pictures, right? Each letter is a picture. Then we decipher those pictures as symbols, right? This is a symbol of an A, a symbol of an R, a symbol of an E. And then we put them together and we form a word. And we read at about 250 words per minute. And regardless of how many years we've been reading, this process never changes, right? Picture, symbol to word. And that means we're not, if we're not aware of that, right? It's and how it impacts how people are interpreting what we're writing or putting into text, that can make a difference. And by the way, this is from Brain Rules by John Medina. If you have never read that book, that is a fascinating book. I think there's 10 basic brain rules, but this is one of them. So let's do another experiment. So go ahead and read this. Okay, I'm kidding. So you don't have to read that, but I just wanted to show that, you know, the image got that across. You know, you could get more information. In fact, there's some cool information here. I learned a term I wasn't aware of, which is a tiger is one of the most popular of the world's charismatic megafauna. Have you ever heard that word? That's an awesome word. I mean, that is like hippos and rhinos and lions and jaguars and so all that stuff. But this, you know, why, you know, how much faster we take in that image, and it's 60,000 times faster, right? So we process an image in 13 milliseconds. And we do that because it affected survival, right? We depend on vision to see tigers, right? So we have a preference for visuals and we're much faster at it. So I can give you facts and data, but if I do it with an image, I'm going to have a faster effect. And often it can affect other parts, right? It can affect us emotionally. And I know there's lots of research out there I won't get into today that most of our decisions are driven by emotion. So just looking at images makes that huge difference. And I used an image to make my case, right? So there's the bar chart. We are used to bar charts. So here's another example. I just got this. I think it was even yesterday. And this is a really interesting example. This came from Angela Duckworth. She's the author of Grit. And I subscribe to her mailing list for what she calls her character lab. And she just sort of produces results of research they've done. This is a recent article she called Seeing is Believing. And this was part of trying to get kids to understand climate change or the importance of climate change, which doesn't have to be just kids. It could be for anybody. But this photo shows, since there were no bees left, right, in this growing region, the farmers had to pollinate their crops themselves. So that, just the impact of that visual tells a story, right? So that right there. And they found that their research was, you know, that using photos combined with information gives you a greater appreciation for the subject, right? Whatever that is. And we don't always have an image that's compelling, right? That we don't, you know, we're working in processes and you might think, well, I don't know what the image is going to be. I'm working in it's a workflow, right? Am I taking photos of the workflow? Like it may not, and maybe you are, right? But the, if we don't have an image, then there's another avenue we can go. So this, also from the book, this is a team lead I was working with. It was a little childcare nonprofit locally here on the Cape. And her project, she's the office manager, she wanted to reduce expenses for the organization by $2,000 a month, right? And she started working on this. And she, because she saw that there were dishwashers and plates and everything in these childcare centers, but nobody was using them. They were using paper plates and ordering plastic utensils. And, you know, everybody was ordering their own soap and cleaners and stuff like that. So she was, you know, putting forth, hey, I bought this new cleaner, you know, because I can get it in bulk and I can get, you know, reduced price. And everyone said, oh, this is horrible. I don't like the smell. It irritates my skin. You know, why are you doing this? What's the big deal? How expensive is the cleaner? So then she went to the CEO and said, what do I do? People are kind of balking at this. And at this point, the process is just buy as you wish. You know, I know they're taking care of kids, but, you know, it seems crazy. And the CEO said, yeah, I back you. Tell me what you need me to do. And then she thought, oh, now this sounds like a battle, right? I'm going to battle with these people, these teachers, these lovely instructors. Like, that doesn't feel right either. So then she said, you know what? If we can do this, we can get another daycare center. We can house more kids. We can service more of our community and people at risk. And it was, you know, that's what we're here to do. And so they all, you know, she talked about that at the next meeting. It wasn't about the target. It was about the why and the story of, you know, the kids they were trying to reach. So then people just fell over themselves. They were like, actually, I've got this phone. I don't really need it. Also, we have these memory stick things. We don't need those. And I think they're being rented. So all these things started coming at her. And I think they hit the goal inside of a month. They got the facility. They got they got bonuses for teachers for the first time ever. They were able to give people raises. It was just massive. It was a massive project that it took her coming back to kind of why and telling people about getting back to who they were working for and telling that story. So that is another aspect of our brains that we might not be aware of. And this is how we process stories. So as a storyteller, right, when you're telling someone a story, whatever emotions you're feeling, right, that's going to light up a certain part of your brain, right? And as you tell the story, the person who's listening to you, if you're explaining something that you felt a sense of terror, they're going to mirror that sense of terror. If you're telling something that made you excited, then the same part of their brain is going to mirror that excitement. So this phenomenon is called neural coupling. And the listener's brain is mirroring the speaker's brain as you tell about a real life experience. So it's almost like it transports people into your experiences. It's almost like they're living your memories. And it's a great way to transfer information. And it's why I remember asking at the end of, if I was teaching a workshop and I'd say, you know, what what, you know, impacted you most or what helped you most? And they'd say, oh, the stories. Yeah, whenever you told a story. And I know a lot of you out there know the same thing, right? You have stories that you go to try to make a point, but that's what's happening when you're telling those stories. So this one comes, I did a little research on the guy named Uri Hasson, if you want to look more into this. U-R-I-H-A-S-S-O-N. He did either a TED Talk or a blog. So what happens when we hear stories? But knowing that, right, it's just one of those things you can leverage, right? This is part of brain science that once we know that, then it might make you think a little bit longer about, well, what story do I have that makes this clear or makes my point? Where can I go to, as opposed to just explaining the facts of a thing, what is my story? So question for you, do you have a favorite method of helping others get at the why of an effort, right? So this is back to, the examples I would give is a friend of mine would always, I'd say I was doing something, she goes, for the sake of what? For the sake of what? Or another one, another colleague of mine would say, and why should I care? And why should I care? And then it's usually a prompt to get at that reality of what's behind it, which might surface the story. A recent one I heard was, I get a lot of projects working with a hospital network right now, and there's a lot of projects focused on reducing the amount of patient belongings that get lost. And often they focus on, well, if you replace a set of dentures, if you replace a hearing aid, you're talking about over $2,000, right? So this is a lot of money. I'd seen about two or three of these projects. And then a most recent one, she said, she told the story of a gentleman whose hearing aid got lost, and he was recovering from a stroke and losing his hearing aid. It took 3 months to get the new hearing aid, and his rehab was stalled for 3 months, right? So he's recovering from a stroke and he's unable to make progress for 3 months. And that was such a compelling method of, instead of the, you know, and of course the money, the cost of the hospital, absolutely. And you want to talk about that impact, that's big. But just that story really shifted the way people heard that improvement effort. Okay. And this one, and this is why I'm such a huge fan of Mark's book, Measures of Success, because this is just a simple time chart, not the sophisticated process capability chart, but it tells a story, right? So that's an image. It's super simple. But when people are trying to figure out, well, how do I put something in my A3 to tell the story, you know, what's the best thing to do? And I often say, well, this kind of tells the story, right? There's the past. There's where we were. There's when you did something and you'll tell us what you did, right? Then that's what happened. So it's just a nice story in a picture that I feel like is resonates for those of us in this problem-solving world. Okay. So now let's transition into what happens, what might happen when we are telling a story. So the opposite of talking isn't listening, it's waiting to talk. And this quote comes from my colleague, John Gaspari. He wrote a lot of books in the quality realm. One of them was I Know It When I See It, which was very popular back in the day. But it just points out what happens during conversation, right? And if one person is talking and the other one is working out what they're going to say next, then the listening is a casualty, right? And this just to me kind of captured, you know, like you're telling someone is telling you something and you're immediately reflecting on, oh yeah, I know about that. That happened to me. Or how am I going to respond to that? Or, you know, I can add to that. And there's lots of reasons that we're immediately distracted. But I remembered I worked in a consulting firm, and this is when I was very young, early in my career. And when we got into the meetings, the consultants, when they were talking, had all developed this really similar stutter. And they would say a point, and then as they're making their next point, they say, and another aspect of that. And I realized what they were doing is sort of forming this barrier from anyone trying to interrupt them. And same thing sort of growing up, we had a big family and a lot of storytellers. And if you wanted, you know, to be heard, you had to have a good story, right? But you might be in the middle of it and someone would say, oh yeah. And then boom, your time in the spotlight is over and your, you know, older sister's got it and they're done with you. So why do we do this? Well, this is one of the reasons. This is how we process speech, right? We speak at 150 words per minute and we understand speech at 400 to 800 words per minute, right? So there's a big gap there, right? There's a huge gap for us to do what we want to do it. So what are we going to do with that time? And what some of us do is we form our next thought, we form our response. We might, we might just fill it with, you know, did I let the dog out? I mean, it doesn't matter. We just have that gap. So what are we doing with that time? So this is, I know, very human. So I do want to hear from you guys this time. I want you to put into chat, how do you overcome the waiting to talk syndrome? If you can, how do you do it?
I'll read off anything that goes into the chat. We'll invite people to participate.
And while you're doing that, I can give you one. I got this from Dorsey Sherman. Oh, what did you hear? What did you see there?
Well, somebody put it, I bite my tongue. take notes while I wait. Work, taking a drink. Have an expectation for myself to reiterate what I heard. That'll help you keep listening, right? Taking notes, consciously deciding to listen. A post-it note that says WAIT is an acronym. Why am I talking? To remind me. Eye contact, actively listening. Focusing on listening, try not to forget what I was wanting to say, biding time, staying quiet, observing, lots of different strategies. And yeah, I think there's maybe a difference, Elizabeth. I almost started answering a question of like, how do you prevent yourself from jumping in, which is different than like, you could be quietly waiting to talk, which is maybe better than interrupting, but then you're not listening, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The waiting to talk syndrome can have two results. One, you jump the gun because you're like, I can't wait anymore. Or you're waiting, but are you listening or not listening? I kind of like, yeah, these are great. I like the bite your tongue. It's a way of getting yourself to pause, right? And I was going to mention that WAIT acronym, Jennifer, that's awesome. Like, why am I talking? Like putting that at the top of the page to remind yourself, okay, why am I talking? What am I adding here? Let me just see some other ones. Breathe. That's nice. Katie Anderson was saying, she's like, she recognized she had a problem. She's like, I'm a teller. I have to stop and listen. And that's really good. And writing helps me. I think writing things down. And also I think someone else pointed this out. When you're writing things down, and I tell people I'm doing that, I'm writing what you're saying. So I'm listening and capturing because I want to come back to things that you're saying that I want to let you, you know, say it all out. But then people, I think it gives a signal to people like you are listening, right? You're taking the time to write things down. So that's also people like, oh, they're actually listening to me. Smiling and think at the same time. That's nice. Yeah, writing. Yeah. No, I think writing is a good one if you can do it. And I have other people that are like, no, if I'm writing, I'm not present. But I do like, if you can be present, that's a good one. Okay. So thank you for those. People have their own way of doing it. But just, I think, being aware of that, that's, there's a reason we have that extra time. I think that helps me. knowing that helps me say, okay, I've got that extra time. I've got to use it wisely. All right. Now, here's another processing speed that impacts us. And this one is the speed at which we speak to ourselves. And that dwarfs the other two. That's 4,000 words a minute. And I learned this from the book Chatter by Ethan Cross. And he's talking about your inner, kind of what results in what you would call, you would have is like inner naysayers, right? If you can, you know, talk yourself out of things, right? If all that time, we spend most of our time in our own heads. So just recognizing what's the impact of that. And this one, this phrase, kind of stop the chattering monkeys, comes from another friend of mine, a late mentor of mine, Ben Nieman, who wrote the book, Free the Genie. And he said, you know, you've got these chattering monkeys. There's, you know, you've all that. Now I know the speed at which they're speaking to me, but that they're, you know, there's a million reasons not to do something, not to try something, not to speak up. And, you know, if that's an issue, how do we surmount that? How do we help other people surmount that, right? Knowing that that's happening for us and other people. And this is some of what I heard from another segment in the book is called The Wisdom of the Crowd. So there's lots of people on this crowd in this webinar who are quoted in the book. They've given lots of techniques, kind of life hacks, examples. And these are just some of what I heard from them, which was list your accomplishments from doing something that you were trying to talk yourself out of, right? What did you then do anyway? Because you never look back, I find, and go, oh, I did that even though I was, you know, afraid to do it. I wish I'd never done it. It's always like, you know, thank God I was brave enough. And I think this is Ruth Archer pointed out, stress, your body processes stress chemicals the same as excitement. So just reframe, instead of being stressed, I'm excited about this. And what do you do with that, right? That gives you energy and you can make use of that energy. Another one, this came from Mike Osterling, and that was around this idea of awfulize. You know, what is the worst that could happen, right? So if you did this, what's the worst that could happen if you did that? And usually it's like, eh, it's not that bad. Might as well try it. Another person offered up having an accountability partner, somebody to go to and say, I'm thinking of doing this, but I think it probably won't work, but have someone else chime in, you know, get out of your head actively, speak to another person and have that different, have a different conversation than the one that's going on in your head. So those I found to be helpful, but that was also just an interesting discovery of the different processing speeds and what they do. So in this last segment on brain science, I want to address the opposite side of chattering monkeys. And that is, you know, what does it take to come up with good ideas? So now I want you to put into the chat, where are you? What are you doing when you get your best ideas? Right? Just consider for a second, where are you? What are you doing when you get your best ideas?
Shower, walking, driving, showering, on walks, showering. So that cliche is true. Shower, thoughts and ideas. Driving, reading, these places where they're hard to write down, right? Just before waking up, that's interesting. Insomnia, sitting outdoors, being quiet, running, talking with others, cooking, showering, walking, sitting outside, sleeping, meditating. Nature walks. Wonder if that's more effective than non-nature walking. Something besides working on the problem at hand, running, praying. Massage therapist business. A lot of solutions come to me while healing clients. That's really interesting. Lots of familiar contexts and some really unique ones there. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, these are great. Ironing, playing with my kid. I love it. Okay. So what's interesting about this, and I've asked this question, I actually got it from another mentor of mine, Mitch Ditkoff, who wrote Storytelling at Work. And I've been doing this for over 30 years. And every time I ask this, they're similar to what you guys just have been putting in the chat here. And no one ever says, you know, in my cubicle, at work, in a conference room, right? Those are conspicuously absent. So even when I remember teaching ideation techniques, right? So, you know, up at a flip chart, and now you can have it on Mural or Miro or some digital board, doesn't matter. But we would do ideation techniques, and you might be familiar with some of them. We'd say, oh, what's the opposite of what you're trying to solve? And that would usually be hilarious, and all the brainstorming would happen, and we'd be laughing, and it would look like exactly what we do. And then it would be like, okay, let's reverse that. And then be like, okay, a reversal, and that'd be fun. Or we'd try analogy. Let's take a different process in a different business and say, how would you solve for that process? And then we'd bring the analogies back, the answers into the analogies back. And they were fun, and we did them. But I remember asking people after I was coaching, and I said, oh, do you do those with your team? And they were like, no. Do you ever do any of the break? No, we just get in a room and try to get some ideas. But I remember that they were sometimes just felt like lackluster. Like it was like, yeah, this is the classic thinking. These are not new ideas. These are not breakthrough. So what was the problem with brainstorming? And when I looked into this is really interesting, kind of counterintuitive that research conducted by Neil Herman. There's an article in Scientific American. He's NIELHERMANN, Neil Herman. So he said he developed these models of brain activity to understand why we're not coming up with our best ideas in conference rooms or on Zoom calls. And four categories of brain waves he's looking at. So beta, now that's what we produce when we're in conversation, we're debating, we're making a speech, actively engaged, you know, in activities like brainstorming, right? Problem solving with the team. It seems like we should get good stuff in this beta wave, but we don't. Or we do, but not as good as we can. So then there's alpha, right? That's we take breaks or we meditate. Another kind of brain wave. Then there's theta waves, which you might be aware of. And we produce these when we go for a run, take a shower, drive a car, walk the dog, and basically engage in all the stuff that you listed, which are kind of what you might call autopilot activities, right? You know, you have friends probably you can sit with and they can knit while they talk to you, like their fingers know exactly what to do. You're washing the dishes, right? It somehow frees your brain, these autopilot activities. Have you ever been driving home, you know, your usual commute, and you pull in the driveway and you're like, I do not remember the last 5 minutes. You know, your mind is somewhere else, right? You're driving like you're describing that it's you're driving silent in silence, right? I don't have the radio on. I like that one. I think that came as one of your being specific. I'm not just driving, I'm driving in silence, because then the brain, I actually go for a bike if I can. If I'm home and I'm stuck on something, I'll go bike. So whatever the autopilot is, that happens there. They also happen when we're drifting off to sleep and when we just wake up. Those are also theta waves. And I don't know, my husband will announce when he's going to sleep, I'm trying to figure out how to deal with the drainage problem. I know I'll figure it out at 3 a.m. And sure enough, he'll wake up in the middle of the night and, you know, they'll be like, problem solved. So it depends on, and some of you might have one preference or the other. Like what happens to you a lot as you wake up in the night, or what happens to you a lot as this happens when you're driving. So those are all theta waves. And then lastly, it's delta. Those are deepest levels of speech, sleep. So not much going on there, usually. So ideal way flow is theta. So how do we take advantage of that. And you can't, like, you know, you're usually not sleeping and showering on the job. So what exactly can we do to make the difference? So just out of curiosity, I think I kind of know it from what you said, though. But I'm where do you prefer? Is it the autopilot or is it the waking up, drifting off to sleep?
Which you what people say autopilot number two, number one, autopilot. I guess that's number one. One, two, cutting the grass. I guess that's an autopilot activity. Looks like kind of a almost 50-50 mix, maybe 60-67% the autopilot activities.
Interesting. I sort of assumed it was more autopilot, but it's interesting to hear that it's mixed. Or what looks like 50-50.
Or, well, maybe it's 70-30. We're getting more votes coming in. I don't know if the votes have been.
I don't know. We're not doing pure science here, Mark. We're not doing pure science. Right. This is just like, we're winging it. All right. So let's talk about then what do we do? All right. So based on your favorite method, there's ways to capture stuff, right? So I keep a pad by my bed. So I always have a pencil and a little spiral notebook. And I just, you know, middle of the night, tell Mark Graben, blah, blah, blah. All right. So I want to capture that as soon as I get it. Cause I don't think it's ever been the case that my brain was a steel trap or any of ours are, right? So those ideas come, you got to grab them. So another suggestion I heard was someone likes Google Keep. Right, an app that they can sync across platforms, capture their ideas, lists, photos. Because some people just like they photograph stuff. They go, oh, that's a good idea. They want to photograph it. You can send yourself messages. I don't know if you've ever done that. I'll text myself, remember this, do this, look at this. Another one is dictating into your phone. I got another friend that likes that. You can use brain writing. You can, if you're working with people, you can even put what I call the how can we question, what's the thing you're trying to solve, and then put that out to people so that they can, you know, sleep and bike and walk the dog and wash the dishes and do stuff in between. Use Siri, Apple Notes, nice. So yeah, lots of different ways here. Now, what if you are facilitating? So facilitation techniques, and these, if you can, some people like to split the workshops over 2 days, right? Give people that time to be on their own, to sleep, and engage in remote or automatic activities. And then another one is you could send folks out for breaks. I think I got these from probably some people on this call. So take a walk in between sessions. That might have even been Tracy Defoe, right? So give people time to go take a walk. And actually walking's interesting. You know, Aristotle had the walking school, right? And the word is peripatetic, right? They would walk. There was no building. But that meant, again, that's an autopilot activity. So then they would talk, which also would spur ideas so that you could even walk with someone else, right? And have some kind of collaboration there. So whatever makes it work. Another one, I think back, we used to get things for people to have in their hands during workshops. I have a box of stuff. I know the most recent one is a fidget spinner, or not even recent anymore. Just Play-Doh, Slinkies. I learned not to have things that made noise because that was just irritating. But people liked having something in their hand. And that I realized looking back now was like, oh, that was autopilot. People were able to sort of do something without thinking, right? And then that would free their minds and they would become more engaged. So whatever, and that requires a little bit of forethought. That would have to be an on-site session, or you can ship stuff out and do something remotely. And yeah, it's getting too complicated. Anyway, so that just other ways to simulate autopilot. Okay, so stepping back, I just gave you a lot of things to think about, the way your brain works, but facts and data may not always compel people. So since we process images 60,000 times faster than text, what are some imagery that will help make the case you're trying to make, help influence people, draw them in? And then remembering now that you know that when you are telling a story, the listener and you are going through something called neural coupling. And to remember that, and to remember how powerful stories are, and to spend time thinking about what stories will help you make your point, help you help other people understand a concept. That we process speech faster than the speaker. And that once you know that, and that you can bite your tongue, you can write, you can count to 10. And that our inner naysayers can work us 10 times faster than we can speak or talk with other people. So when you're starting to talk yourself out of something, who could you talk to that maybe could give you a more rational response or reflection? And then lastly, we do our best thinking away from work. So how do you take advantage of that and help other people take advantage of that and give people time to be on autopilot, to have some brainstorms in the middle of the night? And that is that, Mark Raven. I hand it back to you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Hats off to you for the session today here. We'll have a couple announcements before we will go into Q&A. So I'll invite people, please do submit questions using the Q&A button as opposed to the chat. And Elizabeth's contact information will be up on screen while we do that Q&A. But if you can go ahead and advance that, please, Elizabeth. So we have upcoming webinars. Our next webinar is going to be May 11th, being called right now Habits Part 3. Some of you may know, or you may have attended the first two webinars in the series about habit loops and the power of habits in organizations, as presented very well by Greg Jacobson and Morgan Wright. So that's open to everybody. Registration is not open yet, but you can register to get notified of future webinars, or because you registered for this one, we'll tell you about future webinars, but you can always learn more at kinexus.com/webinars. We have our more than 100 webinars in our on-demand library, past webinars from the last 8 or 9 years, that you can find those again at kinexus.com/webinars or our YouTube channel. Next slide. We invite you to check out our blogs. If you can advance. blog.kinexus.com. There we go. Something new posted a couple of times a week about building a culture of improvement, spreading continuous improvement. We invite you to check that out, blog.kinexus.com. And then finally, I want to tell you about our podcast, the Kinexus Continuous Improvement Podcast. You can find it at kinexus.com/podcasts. You can find it, I think, anywhere you would find and listen to podcasts. Let me know if that's not true, if there's a podcast service you use that we are not in. The audio from today's session will be in the podcast feed if you want to revisit it, if you want to share it with colleagues. We certainly invite you to share or rewatch or listen to this with people when you have time. All right, so with that, we will go into the Q&A. If you can, we'll put up Elizabeth's website, her email address, and I'm also going to put in a link about the book launch party tomorrow. I'm going to put a link in the chat if you want to say something about that as well, Elizabeth.
Say it again, Mark.
Tell us about the launch party tomorrow.
Oh, good. Yeah. Please come to the launch party. Karen Martin, a colleague of many of you, and Tracy O'Rourke, my partner at the Just in Time Cafe, are hosting a virtual book launch party where there will also be there's free books. Well, there's prizes of books and magnets and let's see, what else was there? There's a couple different things. Oh, and mugs. So we've got some fun swag. We have some activities. If you know Tracy O'Rourke at all, you know this will be a very fun book launch party. So I would really love it. Any of you interested, please come, please join us. And Mark has given you the link. It'll be a great time.
Yeah, I plan on being there, and I think it'll be great fun. And again, congratulations on the launch of the book. A question here from Andrus. First off, great work, great summary of these topics here. What's your next goal or topic or focus point right now?
Your next goal, topic, or focus point. Interesting. I think it is, I've been, people find the book has 50 chapters, and each one you could just pick it up. I recently had someone tell me, hey, this book is great for someone with ADD. You can pick it up anywhere. So each little chapter is like a nugget in itself. And someone said, hey, could you make me create a guide that tells people, hey, if you're dealing with the issue of people not listening, what are all the different chapters that would help with that? Or what if you're struggling make sure that you get your point across? Whatever the issue is, I can make a guide for people so they can see what are all the different chapters that would help you with that particular issue. I know there's an awesome index and a great table of contents, but this would be, why not have a little guide that puts it all together for the reader?
I'm not to put you on the spot or create more work for you, but I think each of those chapters could, in a way, become a book. These are a lot of really interesting topics that
I'm making a note of that, Mark. I'm going to start writing that right now.
A whole series. Picture yourself a writer of a series of books. All right. We have a question from Sam, and then I'm going to go to Stephanie. Different question format here, but just heads up, Stephanie, you're on deck, and I'll tell the audience what's going on there. Here's a question from Sam. In most of my meetings, people talk over each other or can't wait to speak until the other person is done. Do you have any tips to address this nicely? Or I'll add on effectively if nice isn't necessarily the way to do it. I don't know. Go.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like it could also be company culture. And I've actually dealt with I worked in South America, and I remember everyone was talking over each other, and someone said to me, but that's how we communicate. Like, that's normal. So obviously it depends on what the culture is, but what I do a lot when I have, I'm with people and I can tell someone has something to say and boom, somebody has just, you know, wiped that out. Right. Then I'll try saying, hey, so-and-so, you were about to say something about X. I'm dying to hear it. Or can you say more about that? Now, when you do that, you've both opened the gate and said, I want to hear that person. You've also let the other person know without pointing at them and going, why do you keep like, you're not putting any blame on them. You're just opening it up. But I found people come back to me and say, thanks for doing that. And thanks for not calling me out. Like, I shouldn't have jumped in like that. I was just excited. I mean, another one of the things I often say is assume good intent, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not the originator of that statement, but just saying that helps. But anyway, I hope that is helpful.
Yeah. And there was a comment on the question from Carl that says, I can relate. We've had to use meeting moderators for a couple of meetings before we get better at this.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, if you have an official moderator, obviously that will help quite a bit, but you can play a backstory moderator or back channel moderator.
And it's hard to navigate this sometimes. I was reminded earlier talking with somebody of a time when I was going back and forth with a client in Indiana and a client on Long Island. In Indiana, it was one extreme where basically nobody spoke unless they raised their hand and got called on. In the New York group, if there were 10 people in the room, 8 would be talking at the same time. And like for them, that was normal. It was acceptable. It was hard for me to navigate, especially going back and forth.
But. Yeah, cultures are so interesting. I remember we had two consulting teams came together. We were going to work with Starwood Hotels and Resorts. In the beginning, it was like, how are we going to partner? We all met together and we were going around the room to say who we are, introduce, and someone would be explaining something and someone from the other team would say, got it. And every once in a while, someone would cut you off and go, got it. And we were, those of us from the East Coast were like, what's going on with this? They keep cutting us off. And they had to explain this sort of norm, cultural norm of being kind to someone, saying, you know, I've got it now. You don't have to relay the rest of the stuff that I've forgotten how it worked, but I still don't like that technique. But having it explained was helping me understand, it's cultural. It's polite for them.
Well, there's I'm sure a little bit of brain science that comes into making assumptions, or I've been exposed to that got it, and it could come across as dismissive, as basically like, okay, just no, I don't want to hear anymore, or but that's, I guess it's always good to ask, or if someone can explain the cultural context.
Yeah.
A big help. All right. So I'm going to ask Stephanie Hill from our Kinexus team to unmute and go ahead and you can ask your question live for Elizabeth.
All right. Hey, Elizabeth. Wonderful job. Very thought-provoking. So my question is, if you are working with a company, doing facilitation of a meeting or an event, and they are very short-staffed, as a lot of companies have been lately, how do you quickly and effectively explain taking time that might be initially perceived as like wasting time for engaging people's theta waves? So taking these big breaks or adding some time for some creative brainstorming, those kinds of things. How would you effectively explain the why behind that?
I might take a different tack. Like if everyone is that strapped and the concept of taking extra time to, wash the dishes is not going to go over. I think delineating between when we're at work, we're doing this, giving people that how can we question whatever it is you're working on to take with them, go home and do those autopilot activities or get those ideas at night and come back in and share, right? So let that not have that. If it feels like it's time is tight for people, that I wouldn't do it at work. I don't know if that's helpful.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you, Stephanie, for doing the question in that format, little experiment. So thank you for doing that. Here's another question I'm going to read for you, Elizabeth, from Sinan. What are some misconceptions about brain science and leadership?
That is fascinating. Misconceptions about brain science and leadership. I'd say one thing, I don't know if it's a misconception, but I think as a leader, we, by the time we've been in the business for a while, we are, we're adding value, right? And we might think that we're adding value by, offering up a nugget, a piece of wisdom that, what we say in the meeting, that speaking is our job as leaders, that we've got to be putting forth ideas. And then the reality is it might be not just good to listen, but your value may shift into what kind of questions are you asking, that as you rise up, that the misconception might be, I should be adding more as opposed to I should be asking more, that stimulating others becomes more of your job than adding, value with a kind of patent idea.
I mean, a lot of it comes down to how does our organization define leadership, right? I mean, there are many different models and definitions that we run across, right, Elizabeth?
Yeah. Yeah. And we've all been, a lot of us have been exposed to the late Edgar Schein, humble leadership, humble inquiry. And I think another misconception there is that, humble means meek, as opposed to, his stories came from the army and, the military. It's like, well, there's nothing meek happening there. So, what does that mean? So really delving into having that space and asking those questions to build those around you. I think that's another thing. It's a shift, right? You're on a continuum that, you're building your own leadership abilities. And at some point, earlier for some, later for some, you realize, oh, I got to build some leadership skills around me. I got to help people build theirs. And that's an interesting transition for folks. And you don't always see it, that that's happened or that it should happen. But that's a thing that I think is people often don't see it until someone points it out. Like, it would be great if you could mentor someone. You're like, oh, all right, I can do that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Elizabeth. We have a question from Luis. When you look at imagery and pictures, have you been able to identify, are there certain image types that lead to or elicit a desired response or emotion from the target audience that you're working with? Let's say animals or food or other examples. Are we using photos to illustrate or photos maybe to provoke a response? Or what are some different ways we could use images?
Yeah. When you said that, I'm thinking, well, animals definitely evoke responses, right? Because those are incredibly cute. You get the cuteness response, right?
Yeah.
In terms of emotion, in, you know, the classic annoying answer, it depends, that you could be, someone was telling me they went to the Gemba, try to understand the particular process they were tasked with, and they thought people weren't doing things because they were too busy. And then they saw, oh my goodness, the noise and the hubbub, like the amount of people. And so just got a photograph of just how many people were in this, you know, area, that how do you get clarity and figure out what's happening if it's, you know, it's so crowded. So, you know, can you, how do you capture the thing that's happening, right? And a classic is the five S's. Those are often like, shocking. How could this place have looked like this at first? Another person recently, it was a physician dealing with what she thought initially was the minor issue of where are the clippers in the ER? Like, we are always searching for the clippers. We have to use them before surgery and often go pilfer them from other ERs and spend all this time. And she took a photograph and said, can you find the clippers? And everyone was like, just searching this thing. She's like, we're like, is that? She goes, nope, that's not them. They're in the picture, but you just can't see them. Because her solution was visual, right? It was, where should they be? All that. But it was really fascinating that she got us all going, wow, I don't see them. And they're right in front of me, apparently.
There's a comment here before we wrap up from Jennifer. Amy Herman has a great book called Visual Intelligence. She helps others realize how important observation is. So thank you, Jennifer, for sharing that. Thank you, everybody, for attending today. Great turnout, great response to the webinar. Elizabeth, thank you so much for doing the presentation today. And again, congratulations on the big event here, the launch of your book, Picture Yourself a Leader, as people see on screen. I'm going to put in the chat once more in the flood of thank you, great job, great insight comments that are coming through. You can register for the launch party tomorrow for Elizabeth's book with Karen Martin and friends. So look forward to that. And thank you again. Thanks for doing the webinar. And hopefully we'll see everybody in the future in the audience, or if you have a presentation to give, reach out and let us know. But Elizabeth, thank you for doing that today. Really enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure, Mark. Bye, everybody.